Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Bald Move Prestige movie. Today, we're going to be talking about 1995's Oscar-winning Leaving Las Vegas, screenplay written and directed by Mike Figgis. It's starring Nicolas Cage and Elizabeth Shue, and it's based on the novel of the same name, Leaving Las Vegas, by John O'Brien, which is semi-autobiographical about his life. Did you know that he was born and raised in Oxford, Ohio, Jim?
No, I didn't know that.
It's less than an hour away from where we live. And like I said, this movie is based on a book that's semi-autobiographical about his life and his struggle with alcohol. And you should probably know, if you've never seen this movie before, what you're getting into, because this person blew their heads off about 2 weeks before or 2 weeks after this film was optioned from his book because of his crippling depression. And I guess the fact that he found drinking himself to death to be entirely too slow and inefficient a process. This is a bleak movie. It's very uncomfortable and unpleasant at parts to watch and difficult. Have you seen this movie before, and what did you think of it?
No, this is the first time I've seen it. It's Nicolas Cage, so I've always had like an inkling of, oh, maybe I'll go watch it at some point. And I had heard that this is the one he won the Oscar for. And I was like, are you fucking kidding me? How could Nicolas Cage, like, it must have been an off year, right? It must have been just like, there was nothing else out.
I kind of think it was, though, wasn't it?
It's like 95? This year, you know, the 8 movies were released. And so one can slip through the cracks, but it turns out this movie is excellent. And Nicolas Cage is excellent. Elizabeth Shue is excellent. I don't know. I went into it not really knowing what to expect, other than I had been warned that it is dark. It is bleak and sad. And that is true. But I also found it extremely gripping. I was just kind of drawn into this guy's life and the way it tells the story, the way it unfolds, like everything about the history of this guy and why he maybe, you know, is the way he is a little bit, is really subtle. And pretty powerful, I thought.
Yeah, I think the story is really efficient in how it sets up. Like you kind of join this guy in his late stage attempt to, you know, drink himself into an early grave, and they kind of tell you everything you need to know about his life story, how he got there, just a little sketch, you know, where he's from, like what kind of position he must have had to be able to pull something like this off. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I've seen this movie once before, and I got to start remembering everything. Anytime I'm talking about like a 90s or early 2000s, late 80s film, I always have to think about, have I seen it, or have I seen the basic cable version?
Jesus.
Or have I seen the late night broadcast version? Because this, I was like 30 minutes into this film when I realized, oh shit, I think I've only seen this on like a late night television or basic cable version. And it's the same story, but yeah, there's a lot of things that lack a certain amount of impact.
Sure, sure. It's not as bad as watching like Pulp Fiction on basic cable, but yeah.
Yes, which is another movie where I think we even talked about. Did we do a Pulp Fiction? Yeah, that like
I think
so many of those scenes are just bizarre, yeah. And they just don't work when you take all the crazy things happening off the screen. But yeah, I'm big Nicolas Cage fan. If you're a long-time Bald Move fan, you know that like Elizabeth Shue is one of my all-time screen crushes. You know, kind of pretty much fell in love with the Karate Kid, and you know, up through Boys, still doing it for me. And it's wild because this movie is kind of peak Elizabeth Shue in terms of just sex appeal and attractiveness, but it's also the kind of movie that makes me want to cut my dick off and throw it into a fire because it's so anti-sexual, or anti-sexualization, I guess. Not anti, it's just like nothing in this movie is sexy. Yeah, it's not anti-sex or anti-sexy. It's just, it's kryptonite for that kind of thing.
And aside from like a poolside scene, like that one is.
But
pretty
even
good,
then,
but
the
like,
context of it, if you're
we'll talk about it because
if you're pervert on that, then you're 16 years old and you don't have perspective on things. It is her walking down the streets of Los Angeles in those dresses is something else. But yeah, and Nick Cage, the thing is Nick Cage won an Oscar for this movie. And I was, because it's been years and years since I've seen this, and I didn't quite remember the nuances of his performance. And the thing is, there's not much nuance to this performance. This is not recognizably a different Nick Cage than you've seen him in almost anything. He has a lot of the same tricks, a lot of the same excesses. It's just this movie fits that perfectly.
Yeah.
You know, this is a movie that... gives him an excuse to have this really broad performance, this kind of like out of control. But you also, like, you know, there's moments where you can see the man he might have used to be,
very
charming mm-hmm. and kind of with it, witty.
Yeah, Nick Cage he's perfect for this role. Yeah, I've seen Nick Cage in a lot of movies and a lot of different levels of Nick Cage. He's got like at least three or four gears. And one of those is like Weatherman, where he'll pretty much just be, you know, there as a normal human actor. He puts on his human suit and he goes into work and he just shows up and does the job. Doesn't get too crazy. And then I've seen him in like Con Air is another one like that, where he's so buttoned up as Nick Cage that he's almost not even on the screen. And then I've seen movies like Vampire's Kiss, where he's just full on insane, or, you know, the scenes in Mandy where he goes insane. This is somewhere in the middle. Like, it's, I don't know. I want to give Nick Cage more credit for this performance, because I think, like, yes, it does fit his style, but he's also doing a lot of very subtle things in just like, well, I don't even know if I call him subtle. Portraying the alcoholic is something that I've seen done in many films.
Right.
And it always, it can be tricky, because if you go too far with it, you can come off as just like, oh, well, this is an actor trying to act drunk and being a little silly about it. Nick Cage, I think, draws that line, because like you said, you do see moments where his personality kind of shines through the haze, right? And you can get a sense of like, oh man, if he had had, you know, three less drinks right now, he'd be super charming and he'd be the life of the party still. And yeah, everyone would love him. And the problem here is that he's had too many drinks for, you know, the last 20 years of his life or whatever. And now he doesn't know where he is, let alone like enough to be super charming around anyone. So I don't know. He's walking that line between like overacting the alcoholic part and not doing enough, and it works really well for me. Like, this is the only movie I've seen Nicolas Cage in that I can go, okay, maybe he does deserve an Oscar for that.
And I think you're exactly right. Like, that scene where him and Elizabeth Shue are having their first date, and he does this like really nifty, like lighting a match and lighting her cigarette. It feels like a very meet cute, and the whole time he's talking like, well, you know, I'm my drinking kind of in control, and you think like, because, you know, we've been watching him for like 30 or 40 minutes, like, yeah, oh boy, well, where does this end up going? And then like you keep on thinking that you're going to hit rock bottom with him, and there's like three different points in the movie where it's like, oh, this must be what he's talking about.
There's a freak out in a casino that I assume is one of those moments.
And I guess for researching this role, he watched like four famous like alcohol binge movies. There's like one's called Under a Volcano. There's Lost Weekend. That's pretty. I actually need to watch both of those movies. He actually called up, I guess, the guy, or the director called on his behalf, the guy that was the star of Under the Volcano. Because Nick Cage was kind of like, well, maybe I should just spend this whole, it's only 28 days. This movie was made for like $3 million and was shot in 28 days. Mm-hmm. I'll talk more about that later. But he's like, well, maybe I can just spend the whole time blotto. And the guy, he said, it's like, you know, your performance is so amazing and natural. How did you do it? Did you get, and he's like, no, I just, it's acting, because if you do that, you won't be able to make this film. You won't make your cat. You won't make your cast call. You won't make your you'll pass out and lose a whole day and all that kind of stuff. You just won't be able to do it. But I guess what Nick Cage did is he got like rip roaring drunk and filmed himself so he could get the cadence and like the way he would slur his speech and kind of get that natural performance. But he said he's like finding the limits to you know, the performance, you know, the method acting, because this is the one case where if you tried to do it, it would it would be bad for your health, number one, and two, it just make a, it would be a terrible picture.
Yeah, he was channeling his inner shaman during this performance. That's the thing, I've come around on him. Like, I, after doing our film fest, our super serious film fest on Nick Cage, and seeing like some of his serious movies, some of his ridiculous movies, like, he's a good actor. He just makes bizarre choices a lot of the time. And most movies, they don't fit in. Here, it definitely does.
And honestly, I think it's on the director and the editor to, you know, decide which palette of Nick Cage they want to paint with, because he's got the whole fucking spectrum.
Yeah.
And if, you know, whatever ends up on stage, on screen is must be what the director was wanting and wanted to keep in the film, because he can do other things, you know. Raising Arizona is another one, pretty reserved Nick Cage performance, all things being equal.
Adaptation is one I think of when I think of great Nick Cage.
Oh my God.
He's so good in that. And he plays two characters. They're both night and day different. And none of them feel like, oh, I'm doing this character, so I got to make this other character completely opposite. No, he's just embodying two different people.
Yeah. And it's even, it's kind of interesting because it's that same kind of The Deuce where they're both brothers. So they're not like opposites of each other. They definitely are, you know, shaded with each other's personalities, kind of quirks. But yeah, they are completely different to the point that where you kind of forget that it's a trick, you know?
Yeah.
Just like in the way you do in watching The Deuce. You talk about this reptile shaman shit. I don't know if you saw the interview with Nick Cage or Roger Ebert did in Nick Cage's hotel room, like right after the premiere. Did you get a chance to read that?
I think I read that one, yeah.
I felt like that's a nice time capsule into Nick Cage, the serious actor, before he started going off into the time displacement reptile shamanism. Like, everything he said about acting and the process of movie making and his insights into the characters and the chemistry between him and Elizabeth Shue, I thought was fucking amazing. Mm-hmm. And I don't know where he just kept on like crawling up inside his own asshole to where you get the, you know, the kooky stuff, or whether he just honestly is a little bit kooky and he doesn't have a filter. And it's been a long time since people said, you know, Nick, maybe you don't talk that way. But I was expect when I saw that, like, oh, he's going to do his interview with Roger Ebert, I was expecting something a little bit more off the rails. It was just like, you know, an actor's workshop kind of thing with Roger Ebert. So I highly recommend you look that up if you want to check it out.
So one of those interviews where you could sort of expect to get some stock answers from somebody in that situation, but he gives like some really genuine, insightful answers.
Here's something. I fundamentally disagree with Roger Ebert's take on this movie. He wrote two reviews. One contemporaneously and one that's like, you know, one of his great movie series where he kind of takes a look back at all the four stars. His opinion is the movie is about like unconditional love and like the beauty and people being able to love each other. And like, I don't agree with that at all, because I feel like the second half of this film, and maybe now if you haven't seen this movie and you're intrigued, you want to get out because we're about to spoil some things.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the Premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well, lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't a joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
But I think at the halfway point of this movie, the thing that you're afraid of happening, or the thing that Nick Cage thinks is going to happen, starts happening, where they start both sabotaging each other.
Sure.
And doing things to deliberately hurt each other. The thing is, there's not a lot of judgment when it comes to that, because they both come to their positions honestly, and they haven't been telling lies and whatnot. But it's kind of like, you know, hey, you got to promise me you're never going to try to get me to stop drinking. And she's kind of like, in return, I'll never judge you for what you do, as far as, you know, hooking for money. And they have about one act of the movie where that kind of goes and holds. But then when he has his kind of first really serious, you know, uncontrolled drinking binge, coincidentally that night she decides to start working. Mm-hmm. And then he gives her the gift of these earrings. And says some, and it just becomes a cycle of, like, they each kind of try to reach each other and get back to that place where she was his antidote. But like he says, that equilibrium is never going to last in this relationship.
Yeah. I mean, when I see this movie, I think this is a movie about loneliness. Because Nicolas Cage's character has lost his family, and Elizabeth Shue's character, Sarah, is pretending to be someone every day, right? She doesn't even really know who she is, because she pretends to be someone else so often. And so when they find each other, these two extraordinarily lonely people just kind of see each other, and there is a love that forms around that. Is it unconditional? I don't know. I mean, I don't think Ebert's wrong in that is a part of this movie, because, you know, these are two people who would be hard to love, I think, in the scenarios they're in. And the fact that they do love each other, I think they love each other. It is maybe, you know, a little bit unconditional there. But to me, it's ultimately about these two very sad, very lonely people coming together.
Why did they get together? I mean, I get the idea that Nick Cage's fascination with Elizabeth Shue is because he so clearly has a type. You know, you see a picture of his ex-wife.
Yeah.
You see the picture of the women that, like, he's instantly kind of attracted to, and he makes these clumsy passes at. She is essentially like that form perfected. And then you see, like, you know, he has this intense, I think it's, you're supposed to understand it's a fantasy, and it turns out it's a direct quote from the novel. That he's in line at his bank, and there's this blonde, and he's talking about, oh, I could love you if you pour liquor over your breasts, if you dripped bourbon between your legs and let me lick it off. And as soon as I saw Elizabeth Shue walking down the street, and she was like, you know, this little therapy, they have this little device where every once in a while they'll cut to like 60 seconds of her on the couch with the therapist, I think.
Yeah, which
she talks about how. Yeah, where she talks about how that's kind of her superpower, that she can become, she intuits any man's sexual desire and becomes that. And I'm like, oh, mm-hmm. Well, she's clearly going to become this bourbon fountain woman for him, and fulfill that fantasy, and ends up doing it. But why does, so I understand why he has this fixation on her. What's the deal, do you think? What's the other direction with Elizabeth Shue?
I thought it was
fascinated
that he didn't want anything from her, like, other than just to stay, like, and it's the same thing she wanted. She wanted someone to stay, right? There's a line later on where she asks him to stay, and that's all she wants. And earlier in the movie, he said the same thing to her. Like, he goes, the first time they meet, you know, it's on the street, whatever. And he goes and he looks for her later and offers her money to sleep with him, because obviously she's, you know, a prostitute. And when they get to the room, he doesn't want to have sex, right? He just wants someone to be there. And I think she sees that and she's like, oh, we're kindred spirits. And she does during these therapy sessions, like, try to figure that out, but she's never able to put her finger on it.
What did you think of these therapy sessions? I kind of found myself at the end of the movie when I was thinking about it, wondering if the movie wouldn't have been stronger. I know one of the producers, one of the money guys on this movie, requested the director, Figgis, to take it out. And he sat down and watched it and said, nope, this is crucial to the movie. Since most of those scenes are her kind of struggling to put things in the words that don't ever actually connect, I kept on wondering what that movie would be like without those scenes in it. Because it's not that they're distracting or whatever. They're just not of a piece of this movie. They're it feels a lot like the black and white scenes in Memento, where it's like, you know, the movie's kind of going in a certain gear and a certain stretch, and he hit this very different thing. Mm-hmm. In Memento, it's doing something. It's providing you a key, a Rosetta Stone to understand the bizarre out-of-sequence events. And this is just like, we're just going to stop the movie and start telling instead of showing. And I don't know that I like it.
I don't know that I needed it.
Right.
Like I said, there are scenes in the movie where she says what she wants, and she's not intentionally like trying to do that, but she does it anyway. You might be right. I don't know that I needed those, but they also weren't super distracting. I didn't find myself going, oh God, another one of these scenes.
No, not like that. It's just more of kind of like, I'm trying to trim the fat off of this Oscar-winning, intense, soul-searing performance here, you know, yeah. If I was editing this thing.
Well, the movie didn't win an Oscar is all I'm saying. Nicolas Cage did.
But there's a lot of other weird decisions, I thought, like introducing her pimp. And then, because I'm thinking that as I was watching this again, I was like, man, I don't even remember this guy being in this movie. And it's like, well, there's got to be some kind of violent confrontation between him and Nick Cage, or, you know, like how does this resolve? And it literally just resolves itself as you go from like the one act to the other. And I'm like, well,
he might be in some kind of trouble with some kind of gang, and they come and like eliminate him, but right before that he says like, I don't want to see you again.
But I wonder if some of that stuff felt redundant, because I've seen The Deuce and it feels like that stuff was all like, a person going in to watch Leaving Las Vegas comes in with a certain amount of assumptions about alcoholism and about prostitution, and those are like, you know, kind of the, you know, how we understand these things and how they work out in society. And I'm like, I thought it was bizarre to set up this conflict about like, but I also think it, the more I think about it, the more I think about how they're trying to set up Elizabeth Shue and Nick Cage's characters as mirrors.
Yeah.
You know, he is like, in the beginning of this film, Nick Cage is in the self-destructive pattern, and he has a moment where he could free himself. Like his boss has finally had enough. They love the guy, but he's causing so much problems that they're going to fire him and give him this insanely generous severance package that he could spend and not work a couple years and get himself sober and do anything he wants. But what he wants to do is go to Las Vegas and drink himself to death. Elizabeth Shue is trapped in this other situation that she can't get out of. She can't see any possible way out. She's already tried to run away from this guy, and he tracks her down and gets into her even deeper. And then suddenly she's free. She's free, and she has all this money, and she can do anything that she wants to do. But what is she going to do? Enable this guy to drink himself to death. Mm-hmm. And I think that maybe that's that's her severance check. That's her like ticket out of here. That's where, in a different kind of movie, her story takes like an upward tilt. But instead, you know, it's also kind of weird how Nick Cage brings her down with him a bit. Like, she's able, this lifestyle, to live in a nice apartment and a nice community and have nice things. And by the end of it, she has been evicted. She's homeless. There's this crazy shot of her sitting on the curb, Sharon Stone style, just not giving a fuck about who sees her or what she does. There's that scene where, like, the way he compulsively drinks is mirrored by the way she you know, Ebert is of the opinion, I kind of think I agree with him, that her taking on that job with the drunk freshman, the drunk college guys, was kind of being self-destructive. Like, it breaks all the rules that she set up in the movie, but she's like doing it to kind of punish herself, in the same way that there is some kind of punishment that, you know, that that Nicolas Cage is going through in this movie.
Yeah, I feel like you need those scenes, though, because like, if you take those scenes out, what's left of Elizabeth Shue's character, right? Like, if you take out the scenes with Yuri, you don't get the stuff about the cuts. You don't get the stuff about like her running from Los Angeles to LA to get the hell away from this guy because there's a bad scene there. You take out the stuff with the therapist. You don't get her really struggling to comprehend why she likes this guy. Her character just becomes so less dynamic, so less three-dimensional. So you needed something there, and those scenes, I think, were not amazing, but they definitely provided something to the film and her character.
Yeah, and you needed something, and just in the same way that we needed those first 15 minutes of seeing Nicolas Cage, he hasn't quite given up yet.
Yeah,
you know, he's still trying to show up to his job. He's still trying to take meetings. He's still trying to form relationships with people. You need to see kind of like what her whole deal is and how she's gotten to this point and what she's, you know, so you're probably right. I did think there's a lot of fact, because like we don't really know what caused this, and the movie in itself doesn't deal with it. Like, there's this line I thought was brilliant with Nick Cage where he says, "I can't remember if my wife left me because I started drinking, or I started drinking because my wife left me." Mm-hmm. I thought that was like an incredibly insightful quote of where he, and it reminded me of something he said in that interview with Ebert, where he said, "And my take on this guy is he's under so much, such an enormous amount of pain that he's decided I'm just not going to feel anything ever again."
Yeah.
Like, I'm just not even going to go one moment of life sober and let myself feel any of this overwhelming pain. And I thought that was there's a lot of this kind of like dualist dialogue where, you know, in that first date that she has with him, she says, is drinking a way of killing yourself? And he says, well, maybe killing myself is a way of drinking.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was.
She's like, oh, very clever.
there's that
self-destructive tendency. The way they spool out his story is really good. Like, they never have a scene where he like sits down with Sarah and tells her, oh, here's what happened, you know, in my previous life. My wife left me. She took my kid. But you get all this through just like a photograph, the line that you mentioned where he says, you know, I don't know if she left me because I was drinking or I was drinking and she left me. And then that line when he's flipping the tables at the casino and he's shouting, I'm his father. Like, that's a moment where the pain flashes through, right? He's as drunk as he's ever fucking been. He's not going to feel anything. And yet here it is bubbling out every crevice that there is. So you get the sense that like this is completely futile. He's feeling it anyway, right? More intensely than he's ever felt it. And this is just that self-destructive behavior you've been talking about.
It reminds me of like a person suffering from Alzheimer's, where they have these moments of clarity where the full horror. I used to, you know, I saw my grandfather go through that one day. It's like where it's like they get this lucidity of like, Jesus Christ, is this what my life has become?
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like that captured the kind of just violent whirlwind that these people put themselves into. The whole, like, you know, he's happy, he's having the time, they're having the time of their lives gambling, and then he goes this bizarre burst of anger that then triggers this insane thing of shame and deep, deep sorrow. But the thing is, it's like having your wisdom teeth extracted and the doctor knocks you out. It's a painful, traumatic experience. He's got his fucking shoe on your forehead yanking, but you're not but you're not going to remember any of that stuff because you're drugged up, right? Like, yeah. He went through all that pain in a moment, but the next day he can't, like, oh, you know, I remember going to the casino and I remember security kind of getting there, but I honestly don't remember any of it. So it's like, it was the pain real if you didn't go through it?
Yeah, and it sort of gives you an indication of why he might not remember why his wife left him, right? Like, he was probably drunk at the time. He was probably very drunk.
Yeah. Yeah. So getting to one of my problems with the therapist scenes with Elizabeth Shue, because obviously, as we've surmised, the whole idea is to kind of get into her headspace. And I don't feel like she's being honest at some points, especially at the end. You know, she's trying to put a bow on her relationship with Ben. And she says, you know, the thing is he just understood me. He didn't expect me to change. And I felt like that was not true at all. And it's something I feel like is what Roger Ebert was taken from this movie, where I just saw that these people were definitely, and I don't know who started what, because that's something that'd be interesting to go through a second one. But like, there is this at one point in the movie, this cycle of like, well, he's drinking. She thought he was going to be this type of drunk, and he's this other type of drunk, and it's a problem for her. So she's going to go out hooking. So he's going to get her a set of earrings, so that she can wear and feel guilty. Like, he even says, like, I hope this like burns your ear when you're with this other man. Mm-hmm. And then, but she's going to go out anyway. So he's going to get drunk and he's going to go out and bring the whole movie. You know, she's got this gift of sexuality that she tries to share with him the entire movie. He, I don't think shit other than on his deathbed, did they ever have sex?
I don't think so.
But he goes out to the strip and brings a hooker back to her bedroom, is having sex with her. And it's just like, you know, and she eventually kicks him out. I don't know. Is this another kind of statement on like denial and what it does for, you know, enabling your own destructive behavior and whatnot? What's the deal with that?
I'm honestly not 100% sure. I know that there are moments where he definitely knows what he's doing. When he, you know, gives her that earring, that's certainly a kind of a, hey, I don't like what you're doing moment. And then,
and I want you to know about it.
Yeah, I definitely want you. I want you to remember it. I want you to wear it.
Yeah.
And then there are other moments where, like, bringing that other prostitute back to his house, or her house rather, I don't even think he's aware that he did that. I think he's so drunk, he doesn't know that anything's even happening here. But that was just my read on it. Maybe that's not true, but
yeah, I don't know. That's the thing, I guess, about people that do this kind of this binge drinking. And it's like, are they aware of the specific behavior that they're doing? Or is it they're drinking to give themselves license for the behavior? Or is it just they're drinking to numb the pain? And that just, because like, honestly, when I watch this movie, I'm thinking, Jesus Christ, there, but for the grace of God, go I, because I have a lot. Yeah. I have a lot of emotional and behavioral issues. Mine are like compulsive behaviors about, like, you know, if I'm worried or stressed about something, I tend to put it off, you know, and I put it off with video games. I put it off with mindless, certain, you know, scrolling through Twitter, watching YouTube videos. And every once in a while, I have this like flash of like, oh, Jesus Christ, what if I put this off too long? And a lot of times I can dig myself out of there and like force myself to do the work. And it's like, it's something I've been doing since I've been a teenager. It started within the fucking high school. And honestly, if I didn't have to do a podcast like on this particular day, or Jim would show up and I wouldn't be prepared, and people like, this is a healthy routine for me, is what I'm saying.
Right. Right.
But I think it's like, instead of like reaching for a gamepad or my cell phone, if I reach for a bottle or a pipe or a syringe, I would be fucked.
Something because that just those compounded moments of that. Yeah.
Yeah, because those moments of panic, because I sometimes have those moments of panic and just like redouble my distraction, right? Because like, I just can't fucking, like, I was going to bring on a panic attack if I deal with it. And that's just like a luck of the draw kind of thing. Like, if I had that history in my family or as a pattern, it's like, oh, I'm feeling bad, I'm, let's have a drink. How the hell do you ever recover from that?
Yeah, that's what I looked at with Elizabeth Shue's, with Sarah's predicament in this movie. Because she, when she goes and she kicks him out, and then she goes out that night and she gets mixed up with these college kids who beat her, and rape her. And, you know, she spends the next 10, 15 minutes of the movie just destroyed. I view that as like the fluke, the happenstance, you know, the chance that could just destroy anyone's life. And it's interesting because, like, if you are a high functioning person, you know, you have a one thing that happens to you that you had no control over sets you back a little bit, and you fix it and you move on. But if you have habits that compound those destructive qualities of an event like that, mm-hmm. it could send you into a death spiral. And it literally does in the case of, mm-hmm. of Ben in this movie. You know, his wife left him. Maybe he was drinking at the time. Maybe he wasn't, you know, he's so foggy. He doesn't even know. But yeah, that sent him on a trajectory that he's compounding, and he's powerless seemingly to do anything about it because of the habits that he has, like you said.
Yeah, and man, I tell you what, usually I like to search for like movie titles and then like Reddit to see kind of like what the movie groups and stuff. I went down a dark hole of like r/ problem drinking and r/ alcoholic depression and r/ stop drinking and people's personal relationships to this movie. And there's this, Jesus Christ, there's this one kid who said, like, from the time he was in, like, freshman year of college, he had this ritual where he would start watching this movie and he would match Nick Cage drink for drink.
Oh.
And then he would pass out. Usually I would get to, like, I would, if I was lucky, I would make it to the scene where he's, like, whistling, you know, like when he gets laid off and he's at the liquor store and he's just like doing a supermarket sweep of all this booze. Like I'd get to that point, I'd pass out. And then it's like several hours later, I'd wake up and I'd rewind to the place in the movie where I passed out and I would just do it again. And I would just do that as like a daily ritual. And he did that from the time he was like 21 till 32. And there's all this other stuff like these. It's just really, it's harrowing, man. It like really shook me. I spent like an hour reading these different experiences, these people's personal relationships as this movie. And it's wild. Like people were like, one of the things I saw in the trivia is that like Nick Cage never eats in this movie. And I guess that's also very common for alcoholics because they spend they're either super hungover or they don't want to, you know, they don't want food getting in the way of the alcohol absorbing in their system.
Or they're going through withdrawals and don't feel like eating.
There's this one like really crazy thing in the movie where she gets him some food and he acts like he's going to eat it, but then he takes a chopstick and he like eats an ice cube instead. Mm-hmm. 'Cause I didn't notice the fact that he didn't eat the entire movie, but I noticed that and I'm like, oh God, this is bad news. But I guess, yeah, that's another thing that the a lot of alcoholics identified with.
And it's a cycle too, you know, the shame that comes along with having a problem with drinking, I think, can, you know, feeds back into the drinking problem, right? And causes you to just do it more. Yeah,
substance abuse.
I know that. I'm also a chronic procrastinator. And luckily it's not so detrimental to my life that I can't function. But I understand that, like the guilt and shame you feel over doing that just causes it to get worse, and causes you to be more dysfunctional.
Yeah, and you make all these bargains with yourself, and if you then add something that's got your mind fuzzy, and the on top of that, it's just like how do you ever crawl out of that?
Yeah.
And there's this other, like, you know, these dual scenes. Like, of, you know, her getting thrown out of the casino with him. And then there's this other setting where she goes to this getaway and it looks like they're going to have a good time. And she finally becomes his booze bourbon angel. And they're going to have sex. And then he falls through his plate glass thing, and cuts himself up real bad. And this lady comes out and throws her out in the nicest way. And like, she kind of like for the first time sees herself in this. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's no longer she's the one apologizing for the behavior. She's now the screw up too with her loud drinking, her loud conversations, and and like I said, man, some of this stuff is like I had to watch through like fingers, you know, like it's just the secondhand shame and embarrassment was almost lethal, let alone actually being in that situation.
And she seems more resilient than Ben, especially in the early goings of this movie. Like she is able to function pretty well. You know, she recognized the situation she was in. She tried to get out of it with Yuri, right? She moved to a different city to try and better her life, and it followed her. And I think that's something too, right? It probably feels like when you have a habit, a problem like that, that it follows you around and you can't escape it. Literally,
the other thing. The other thing I think that the therapy scenes do is, because I get the impression that these are after Ben's died.
Yeah.
Is it's a little bit of a silver lining to the movie that, like, you know, Ben is a human shipwreck and he's going to sink right to the bottom. But she was able to get out from that undertow, find a lifeboat and start engaging in healthy, you know, talking about the things, engaging in healthy behaviors, seeing a therapist. She looked healthy in those scenes.
And without those scenes, like, yeah, this is an even bleaker movie. And I know that those scenes, like you said, were added for the film. So what is the book must just be a brutal depiction of alcoholism. Like, and I mean, you know, the guy killed himself after the movie options were, the movie was optioned. That was like 4 years after he finished this novel. And apparently, like, his father said when they were making this movie, he told them, look, this is his suicide note, you know, get it right. Like, yeah, it's,
and it's dark. That was where I was going to take it to next. Cause when I was going through all these drinking subreddits and these people's relationship to this movie, people quoted long passages from this book, and it's kind of very Jack Kerouac stream of consciousness. Again, that dialogue that Nick Cage has in line at the teller where he's talking about, you know, I can only lick the alcohol and make you clean and then send you off to fuck other men. Like, that's literally stuff from the book. It's very bleak. And this guy wrote two other books that he never finished because of the alcoholism, and his sister, I guess, finished them, and they were published posthumously. But the director, yeah, there was, like, you know, when this guy killed himself 2 weeks after they bought the movie, there was kind of like, should we even do this? Is this like a cursed project? And I guess, like, this guy's family was very supportive in making it, and they decided that they were going to do this as kind of like a tribute to John O'Brien. And use this to try to get everything just right. And there's a lot of weird coincidences. Like, I guess Nick Cage happened to pick out the same watch that John O'Brien actually owned, this 93 Daytona. I probably wasn't the exact year. He drove the exact make and model of BMW that this guy had, just as like choices that he made. And his dad said, you know, John, that was John's actual. And like, I guess, like, Nick Cage was kind of freaked out by how, like, cosmic those coincidences were. You can see a little bit of the Lizard Shaman creeping
for sure,
in,
even
back in 95. But yeah, they this movie almost didn't get made. And the way it did get made is extremely guerrilla. He made it for $3 million, or $3.6 million, shot in 28 days on location. They used 16mm film to keep the cost down and to keep it, because they didn't get permits for any of the shot of the Vegas Strip. So it's just like, a lot of these were just single takes. Like, you guys got this take and then we're going to run because the cops are on their way.
Yeah.
And it looks like that. It does look like, and I think that works too, because there's this, like, it's funny because, you know, when I was growing up, Vegas was always romanticized in, like, the Rat Pack days, where you had the old strip with the cowboy waving to you and all that. And I realized watching this movie, this is another era of Vegas that's already gone. This is the era, like, right after the mafia got kicked out and it went legit, but before they had all the family-friendly bullshit that is, like, it's now kind of like Disney World and adult strippers all stacked on top of each other. This was all that, just, it was now a legit enterprise. Your hands aren't going to get busted with hammers if you try to count cards, but they don't have the, like, gondola rides and the zip lines and all this other, like, all that other bullshit. It's just Vegas, man. And that Vegas doesn't exist anymore, just like the old Vegas doesn't exist. They turned the old Vegas into a tourist trap version of the old Vegas. And I thought this kind of the old timey feel, the 16mm, and the director himself talked about how that, like, gives it, like, like almost pastel palette, because the colors are not quite as crisp as you're used to a 35mm, especially the new digital processes. It's a little bit softer. I just thought it really suited it and made it feel like, yeah, this takes place in 1995, but, like, there's some movies, like, we just watched The Professional. That thing looks 90s as fuck. The hair, the dress. This kind of has that timeless feel. I don't think it was deliberate, but it's just, you know, it's a guy who is not concerned about looking stylish, and a prostitute that's wearing a prostitute costume and kind of, like, no man's Vegas, this time capsule Vegas, and I thought it looked great.
The fact that, you know, that you mentioned it, that they just kind of smash and grabbed these shots when it rolled into Vegas, you know, put a camera on a tripod, said action, and then ran. Mm-hmm. That gives it a feeling like you're actually there too. It's not a staged thing, right? Where they've paid a whole bunch of extras to walk through the shot in a very particular way. It's just people being people, and sometimes you can see them turning around, looking at the camera, right? Like almost a documentary style feel at times. And the low film quality helps with that. It all comes together really well. The score too, which we haven't talked about, Mike Figgis, I don't know if his full name is Michael. Super talented guy, apparently. He wrote the screenplay here, adapted it from the book. He directed the film, and he wrote and composed most of the score of this film, apparently. Which to me is like, oh, okay, you're the triple threat, right? You can't sing, act, and dance, but you can write, direct, and score. And like, holy shit. Mm-hmm. The score is so good too. It's like this blending of blues. It kind of starts out with one tone and ends up with another tone, right? It goes blues to jazz to something else entirely. It's like
operatic because Nick Cage during that one scene where he picks up the hooker, starts singing.
Right.
What is it, like Figaro, or is he's doing? I don't know exactly which one, but. And I guess that was a choice that Nick Cage made, and I think it informed the score, because the guy's like, shit, yeah, now it's going to turn into opera. Yeah.
For sure. And it works, you know. It takes me through the phases here of how I should be feeling, right? Like, at the beginning, you can almost feel like, oh, well, you're on this kind of fun ride, but it's sad, and there's the blues tone, and the jazz is like, they don't know what's going on here, right? They're in this relationship that they're just trying to feel out. It's like improvisational. It's loose at times,
and it feels like it's good. It's a collaboration. They're working together.
Right.
You feel like the antidote. I feel like I want to live again, but it's not going to last.
And then it turns into tragedy, right? The opera comes in, and yeah.
Their actual sex scene is one of the most sad things I've ever seen. Feels like, you know, that scene in Seven where the dude has been strapped to the bed, like, the sloth.
Force fed.
No, not the glutton, but the sloth, where it's like, he's like withered to a skeleton. Feel like Elizabeth Shue fucked that dude. And I was watching it. It's just grim.
I mean, he's actively dying during this. It's like,
yes.
Yeah, it's no good. No good at all.
Yeah.
I think it's perfectly played by Nick Cage. Like, I don't know what it looks like to die of liver damage and alcohol poisoning, but I imagine it could look something like this. That's one of the things. You don't often see a portrayal, and I think Nick Cage was talking about this when he did that interview with Ebert. It's hard to get a hold of footage of, like, withdrawals from alcohol, like the symptoms of that, right? And what happens to the human body, because, like, yeah, you can get it with meth and heroin and shit, but it's all, like, very similar, you know. It's it's the body dealing with not having a substance it needs, and so it's convulsing, it's sweating, it's trying
organs
to
failing,
yeah, it's trying to kickstart itself and also export these toxins that it's got in it. It's bad news. And I think, like, this is the most intense and, I assume, accurate portrayal of something like that I've ever seen.
That's one of the most, that was one of the most harrowing threads I read on r/crippling alcoholism, is someone said, is it possible to drink yourself to death like it's shown in Leaving Las Vegas? And there's all these people said, like, no. You literally, like, yes, but it'll take you 15 years. You're not going to do it in four weeks or 2 weeks or whatever.
Well, I get the impression that he's been
people
doing
saying
it,
like,
though.
Yeah, like people said, like, well, I've tried, you know, to do it for, and it's like, it's actually surprisingly hard. And it's also like, you know, they talked to, and then I read this particular thread was from 9 years ago. And I was thinking, like, Jesus Christ, where is this person, this thread starter that was, like, wanting to do this? Like, what's going on with them now? It's like,
yeah,
I don't know. It feels like going through a haunted house, some of those threads. Cause you know, like, you know what the alcoholism recidivism rate is. It's not good. Like, even if you get help and do all that stuff, like, I think the best is like, you know, 20-25%. So you just go through and like, you think about, okay, you made it, you didn't, you didn't, you didn't, you made it, you didn't, you didn't, you didn't. Yeah. Fuck, man. Like,
yeah, I mean, it's,
this is a real bummer of a movie to watch and research for that reason.
Yeah, for sure. But it's also a hell of a movie, you know. It's mm-hmm. it's a window into a sort of life that quite a few people have, that is something entirely alien and yet also very familiar to me. Like mm-hmm. you said, with everybody's got issues, you know, that they deal with, I think. And some are more crippling than others, some are more debilitating, but this is a particularly nasty one. Any type of substance abuse is a tough one.
It really is. The one other thing I want to say about this movie is, out of nowhere, Laurie Metcalf, Roseanne Barr's sister from the old Roseanne show, comes in as the landlady and does like...
This is who you're picking? There's so many fucking cameos in this movie, and you're going with...
Roseanne's sister, because I thought, number one, like, for the first half of the movie, or for most of the second act, she's comic relief, uh-huh. you know?
Yeah.
And then she becomes, I guess, like the villain. And I just like wondering, like, can you kick someone out like that? I guess, like, if it's a prostitute, then there's not much they can do, because
right. Can I go to the law?
You can just well, you're an outlaw, so I can do whatever the fuck I want with you. But I thought she was really good as playing this like proto Karen landlady. All right, smart guy, what's your cameo?
I mean, Arlie Ermey's in this, Xander Berkeley's in this.
Wait, whoa. Where is Arlie Ermey in this movie?
He's the guy who turns her down in the bar. Yeah, she goes in and she tries to start hooking again.
He's the guy who's from, he said, oh, is it that obvious? I mean, oh, I did not know.
No,
that.
He's the guy who makes the big scene when she tries to come on to him, right? And says, hey, you want to
yeah,
go
yeah,
to
yeah.
The-?
I had no idea. How did I not know that?
I have no idea, man.
It's dark. I didn't get it.
He does God look a little damn. Different. He looks a little bit like a wolfman. He's got a beard. His hair is darker than you're used to seeing, probably.
Right, because I'm used to seeing it high and tight, kind of silver fox, clean shaven.
It's longer, granite for cliff. Sure. He's wearing a suit, which you're probably not used to.
He also wasn't screaming in the beginning. Like I remember, I remember the performance. I cannot place his face on that. Wild.
Xander Berkeley is a cab driver who gives her shit.
We just saw
in Gattaca not even a week ago, I think.
Yeah, supposedly they had him do a blues song like in the car, and Figgis cut it because he thought it was a little indulgent.
Okay.
Who else? Richard. Who's the guy that's in Curb Your Enthusiasm? Lewis. Richard Lewis is in. He plays one of his talent agent friends that kind of gives him one last loan before throwing him out.
Lou is it Rawls? Also had like a song that I think they cut as well.
That's the one I'm talking. I thought you were talking about him. I don't know who's the Xander guy then.
Xander Berkeley. He plays a fuckface Gregory in Walking Dead.
Oh right. Yes. Yeah. Yes. 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 I also, there's another piece of trivia is like no alcohol company would allow them to shoot their alcohol. So like they had to change the negatives to like flip the bottles, like reverse them or make them negative. So they were disguised. Another thing is, I guess I kept on seeing these red mullet things on the taxis, and I'm like, what the fuck is this? And it turns out that's Mike Figgis's production company, and that face that you saw on it, that's his face.
Okay.
Yeah, I thought that was a fun little detail.
There are a lot of other people here. I think John Lennon's son is in this movie. I don't even know all the cameos. There are so many people in this from the 90s that you probably know.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to think. Olivia, is it?
French Stewart is in this briefly.
Is he? Where's he?
Yeah, he's... I want to say it's when Yuri first shows up. He's credited as businessman number two. This must have been before 30 Rock. Otherwise, he probably would have got an actual part.
Sure.
Or not 30 Rock, sorry, Third Rock from the Sun.
Mariska Hargitay.
Uh-huh.
She's the main lady from Law and Order SVU. She's the hooker that he brings back to Elizabeth Shue's house and tries to have sex with. There are a lot of, yeah, there's a lot of cameos, but I mean, the movie is all about this Elizabeth Shue and Nick Cage. Like, it's like the cast list is pretty trim as far as, like, you know,
oh, yeah,
actual people.
They're in it
lines
for
and whatnot.
Maybe a few minutes at a time. The other thing about this movie I want to talk briefly is about the success of this movie. So obviously we've talked about Nick Cage winning an Oscar for this film. It's the only one he's ever won for. He's been nominated one other time for adaptation. Didn't win that though. This movie was actually up for 4 Oscars. Nicolas Cage is the only one who won. Elizabeth Shue was also up for an Oscar this year for this movie, but she lost to Susan Sarandon in Dead Man Walking. Best director for Mike Figgis, he lost this year to Mel Gibson for Braveheart. And the best adapted screenplay by Mike Figgis, he lost to Emma Thompson for Sense and Sensibility. So only one Oscar won, but 4 nominations. And in the box office, it was a success. They, like you said, they did it for just under $4 million for this entire film. And it went on to make like $50 million worldwide. So,
wow,
it's 10X investment, not bad.
This Mike Figgis, I looked at his, he does a lot of just experimental art house indie films. His filmography is, I have no idea. He's had one or two things that I think were studio, but I kind of heard one or two of them, but I've never seen a single thing he's ever done. He actually, I think, directed a couple episodes of The Sopranos. Like, he did a couple of TV things that I heard, but, yeah, it's wild, you know. Usually when I see something like this, this auteur, it's like, you know, especially from 95, they'll have done other things, and he's done a lot. He's had a long career. It's just all really weird, low budget, experimental stuff like this movie itself. Yeah, it's a kind of a one hit wonder, a little bit.
Yeah, certainly in the circles we run in, I'm sure he's well known in other circles. I did think it was hilarious to see Nick Cage screaming snake eyes in this movie, because of course he's in a movie called Snake Eyes later. And he's in a very Nick Cage moment there.
Yeah. What do you do if you divide? What do you do when you divide 16mm by 2? 8mm. Yeah, he starts screaming. I feel like I'm between the rock and a hard place, and
I looked it up. I couldn't find any information about Sting's role in this soundtrack, because he has a couple of songs, this Lonesome Old Town thing or whatever, and then also Angel Eyes. And I didn't know if he wrote these for the film or if it was just they picked a couple of Sting songs they liked. Don Henley also has a song in this, so.
Yeah, I don't know anything about that either. I did see that Figgis did the music design. But it's great. Like I said, it's one of those things where it's like, it's a great film, but holy hell, I can't imagine watching it. I might want to watch it one more time, or boy, I tell you, if I could find a director's commentary or a Nick Cage commentary, I'd watch the hell out of that.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things where it's like, man, if I watch it one more time in my life, it's probably going to be enough because it's just so sad. And I think that the more, like, I don't know, it'd be interesting to watch it one more time, knowing exactly what happens and like trying to like, you know, chart each kind of like way station in his way to oblivion. But that's what it is. It's it's uncompromising. It's bleak. It's a hard watch. Well, that's going to do it for our talk about Leaving Las Vegas. We left. Actually, we've made it this whole fucking podcast without mentioning Sheryl Crow once.
Did we? I could have sworn we did at the beginning, but we also did it before the podcast started, so I don't know.
As far as I know, no relation. There is absolutely zero relation between I heard
except
there
in my
rumors,
head, because I can't look at the title of this movie without hearing that song in my head.
that album came out like 1 year before the movie came out. And there was rumors, or I saw some kind of threads that people said that that song itself was based on the novel. I can't imagine.
I don't know. I went down a minor Sheryl Crow hole while researching this movie because I love that album so much.
And sure, it's a great album.
I had it stuck in my head, obviously. Apparently, Tuesday Night Music Club, which is the title of that album, is like a... It was spawned from this group gathering that they used to have of artists, like not necessarily just musicians, but like lyricists, poets, writers, musicians. Mm. And the album is mostly like pieces of those things kind of stuck together. And they called it Tuesday Night Music Club because they got together on Tuesday nights.
Well, that is definitely, we are leaving Las Vegas like Sheryl Crow. And we'll be back next week, not with a Prestige, although it's always a little bit of the discussion when we're talking about this movie. The next installment of The Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers. We've got another commissioned podcast. So if you want to see our movie, for next week, you're gonna have to check it out on Bald Move Pulp. Until then, I'm Aaron.
I'm Jim.
See ya.